Welcome back to the Center for Children, Families, and Workforce Development podcast at the University of Montana. I'm Zach Reamer. So today, I have a great interview for you from an occupational therapist, or OT for short, Chris Graydon. Now, Chris has a practice right here in Missoula, Montana, and has been working as an OT for about 35 years. We're going to hear a little bit about her work and the work that OTs do with children. Some of you listening may be thinking the same thing that I was before I conducted this interview. What is an occupational therapist? Well, if that's you and I just read your mind, then you're about to find out. However, many of you probably have a pretty good idea of what an OT is and does, and you're more curious about the type of work that they do with children and families. Whether you know or not, I think you're in luck. And I think that you'll learn quite a few valuable lessons from a discipline that I learned is strong in creativity and delivering effective services. Now, Chris and I had a long and wide-ranging conversation, so I'm going to do some things a little differently and take a more active role in guiding us through this interview. So you'll be hearing a little bit more of my voice than usual. In fact, we're going to break this interview up into two separate episodes, so be sure to stay tuned for our next installment. Now, before I get started, you might also hear a bit of a steady thudding in the background every so often, like somebody's jumping rope. Well, that's because somebody probably was jumping rope. The room that we used for our interview was right next to this gym, where a few kids were right in the middle of some really cool therapies when I arrived. I'll get more into this gym a little bit later. Oh, and here's a bonus fact for you. I recorded this episode in April, which is Occupational Therapy Month. So if you know an occupational therapist, give them a big hug and tell them Happy OT Month. All right, so let's dive in. We'll turn to my interview with Chris. Okay, so I'm here with Chris Graydon, occupational therapist. Chris, why don't you introduce yourself? Tell me a little bit about yourself, what your background is. And then I'm interested in hearing what an occupational therapist is, because I think a lot of people aren't really aware of what occupational therapists do.
Right, that's always been the hardest part of my job. So my name is Chris Graydon. I am an occupational therapist. I've been an occupational therapist for 35 years, and I went to Temple University for my undergraduate degree, and then years later I got my master's degree from A.T. Still University, Arizona School of Health Sciences, and then I also just recently completed my certification as I am board certified in pediatrics from the American Occupational Therapy Association. So my career started in psych, actually, and that's kind of where occupational therapy evolved from. And I started an occupational therapy department in acute care psych unit in a general hospital in South Jersey. And from there, I've kind of had a diverse career. I did some hand therapy, and I also worked at a rehab, and I eventually worked in long-term care, as well as a school district, early intervention, private practice now, and school-based I've done a couple of different times. So, pretty diverse career. So that kind of leads me into occupational therapy. And occupational therapy is a very broad field. The best way to describe it is that it is focused on those activities we do every day as human occupation. So it doesn't have to be a paid job. It is the things that you do, like self-care, to going to work or to socializing with friends, to driving a car. And it's based on when you or I have an interruption in life or in a skill that we would focus on that. So let me give you some examples. A person that might have had a stroke, they might have lost the use of one side of their body. And so teaching that person how to be able to, not only would we help to rehab that side of that body and try to get it back to as much function as possible, but how do you function if you don't have one side of your body? So working on adapting skills or methods to get dressed using only one hand, or tie a shoe one-handed, or type one-handed, or take a shower, or drive a car, or cook if you were a parent taking care of a child and you only have the use of one arm. So that's one example. In the example of kids or pediatrics, those skills a lot of times haven't been developed yet. So on one hand, I was talking about rehabilitation. We're talking about habilitation, which is the development of skills. And so for a child, their human occupation is based on play. And that's how we develop a lot of the skills. And then moving into the occupation of being a student, but also the occupation that you participate in as a child is learning how to take care of yourself. So mm-hmm. getting dressed, buttoning, zipping, or being able to ride a bike or play with other kids. Maybe a child with autism. Some of the kids that have autism that are higher functioning don't quite know how to engage with others, so they don't get the how to move into a group and position their body in the group and then say, hey, can I play? And initiate. So they might be lacking some of those skills, or they don't have the awareness of some of the unwritten rules. So that would be high level. There's some kids that don't have speech and language, and that impairs them too. So that interruption in their human occupation is that they're so focused maybe in their own world that they have a hard time being able to realize that there's another person in the room and that the other person is actually fun to play with. Let me give you an example of that. So early on, kids when they're like 6 months old, you can see a child playing with something and all of a sudden the child will stop, kind of look over at mom, look back at what they're doing, kind of, hey mom, do you see what I'm doing? That's called joint attention. That is missing oftentimes in a lot of kids that are pretty impaired with autism. Mm-hmm. So they don't have that joint attention and that ability to focus and engage and re-engage. So that's one example. I have kids that have Down syndrome. Mm-hmm. And so they might not have the motor skills to be able to perform writing skills or just even moving their body through space and time, being able to climb on and off pieces of equipment or just being able to brush their teeth because their coordination is impaired.
When I was doing the initial research, the tagline I came across was, it's the occupation of living is what occupational therapy helps people with. And so that breath lets you kind of engage with people at any stage of development.
Exactly. So it's really looking at developmentally and holistically what is preventing this person from engaging or accomplishing or successful participation in the roles and routines that they would do maybe with their family or at school or in the job. And so it's really broad on one hand, but then also that holistic piece is really huge and developmental. What skills are they lacking? What impacts them? So
you mentioned a few already of types of people you work with, especially children with, say, autism or Down syndrome. Can you say more about the types of brain-based disabilities that you see?
So autism being one brain-based, Down syndrome definitely because it's chromosomal. Then I also see kids that have cerebral palsy, which is also brain-based. They might have had a stroke in utero, you know, a brain bleed in utero, or it could have been from the delivery or postpartum time that they end up with cerebral palsy. Rett's is another syndrome that's brain-based, and I've worked with a girl with that for a long time. Just recently, a child who is a young boy around 4 who has a spinal cord injury. So that's a little different. Could be a combination of brain-based in that there might have been a head injury that occurred with that or not.
So at this point, I wanted to get Chris's perspective on one of the serious concerns that Montana is currently facing. And that's how unborn children can be affected by the drug use of their parents and how an OT might work with these kids. A baby is born addicted to drugs every 25 minutes somewhere in the U.S., The Montana Department of Public Health and Human Services reported that 432 newborns had been born addicted to drugs between 2000 and 2013, with a tenfold increase in drug-affected births in that time period. According to Billings Hospital records, 70 babies were referred to the Neonatal Intensive Care Unit, or NICU, for signs of withdrawal at St. Vincent Hospital in 2015 alone. Go back and check out the episode in which I interviewed Dr. Bonnie Stevens for more information about the effects drug exposure has on infants. As kids grow, the impact of drug exposure in the womb can follow them through their lives and into school. Discussing this with Chris took us deeper into a conversation about what those effects can be and how an OT can help. One of the things we're interested in is this increase in drug use in the state, especially opioids and methamphetamines, yes. And how that's affecting children who are being born yes. affected by those drugs. Have you actually worked with kids who have been affected by yes. drugs in utero and are now developing?
Yes.
Can you tell me a little
about
that?
So I have worked, a number of kids I have seen actually have been in the foster care system and then adopted. And so some of those kids were removed from pretty difficult situations right. and were exposed. And I have some whose parents, you know, I see currently whose parents might have used. And mm-hmm. so the one child has cerebral palsy as a result of being yeah. born premature, some sensory issues, just developmentally having some delays, and the ability to focus. So some of the things that I often see with kids that have been exposed are they have issues sometimes with sensory processing, which we haven't really talked about, but sensory processing is something all of us do, and all of our systems are different. Your system is different than mine. So we were all taught about five basic senses, but
sure.
there's actually three more. And the other three include vestibular, which is through the semicircular canals in your inner mm-hmm. ear, and you have three planes. They're put in three different planes, so it tells your head and your body where you are in space.
Okay.
And that has to do more with movement. So swinging and spinning, driving a car, that's all vestibular. Proprioceptive input, which is one of the other senses, is through your muscles and joints. And that is through the input you get. Gravity feeds into that. It feeds into the vestibular a little bit too, but it's knowing how your body's positioned, and so it's muscles and joints. So even if you close your eyes, you can tell that your body is, you know, your knees are at 90 degrees, your legs are at 90 degrees. And if you were to tap your foot 10 times on like the right side, you would feel your brain would suddenly be more aware of that right leg from tapping. That's all proprioceptive input. So pushing and pulling, heavy work is the term for proprioceptive input. And it's actually an early brain stem, just like vestibular. It's early developmentally. It develops in the child so that the baby can work against gravity and gets to know where their body is in space and pushing up on the floor into a crawling position. And then the third, it came out like in the 60s. There was somebody, it was a psychologist, I think, or a biologist that talked about interoception. And interoception is that awareness of your internal body state and your feelings, so which makes sense in that if you're hungry, you want to, everything we do is to stay in homeostasis, right? Or to mm-hmm. stay in that balance. And so your body then tells you, oh, you're really hungry or you're thirsty. So then you go get yourself a drink of water.
Right.
Or you feed yourself. Or for a child, they have to tell you in some way by crying or whatever that they're uncomfortable, mm-hmm. that they need something. And you kind of have to try to figure it out. Oh, they're thirsty, or they haven't had
right.
a bottle in a while. So interoception, and it's also about your feelings. So, you know, that you're sad, or you're happy, or you're anxious. And so you get that knot in your stomach, that interoceptive awareness that, oh my gosh, I'm really anxious. Anyway, so those are really important. And the kids that have been exposed, they might be hypersensitive to sound, would be an example. So, you know, that they hear things. So like there is a clock that's ticking here right now.
Sure.
You and I are totally blocking it out until we suddenly
yeah.
bring our attention and focus
sure.
to that, right? Or maybe from their own past experience, a certain sound has set off, or yelling and screaming, meaning something's going to happen. I don't know what it is. So there might be some anxiety tied to that, and then they're hyper-focused on sounds. Or it could also be that their sensory system is just hypersensitive to sound, and so a siren is all like painful to their ears. And so all of a sudden, when they start to hear it coming, everything else shuts down. They start to melt down or cover their ears. So that would be like auditory issues. Some might be certain smells, which is also brings back a memory,
right,
positive or negative to somebody. I live with somebody who actually is hypersensitive to smells, and so a woman wearing perfume, like in the store, is enough to
sure.
set them over the edge. To us, I'm the other end. I don't smell things that other people smell. You know, I'm a sensory under-responder. You can kind of be some of each. You can be hypersensitive on one hand, and they can be sensory under-responders. I have a girl that I saw who was in Watson's for a few years and was in a couple of foster homes, was exposed, and there might be some other issues that have occurred for her, but she was having enuresis, so she was wetting her pants and wetting the bed, and so my role then was also trying to increase her body awareness and playing games like playing crab soccer or doing some activities that could also increase her awareness of just increasing her abdomen strength, but also her whole body. She kind of had disassociated a bit. Once again, another broad thing that OT would address. Sleep issues I address. A lot of kids that have been exposed have sleeping issues. Eating is mm-hmm. another area of human occupation we all do, but kids who have been exposed or kids who also might have been in the NICU or might have been intubated often have feeding and eating issues. And so they become picky eaters. Kids that are on the autistic spectrum are very picky eaters, and sensory kicks in a lot. The smell of food, the look of food, too much on their plate, only wanting certain kinds of foods. I was a picky eater. I'm a reformed picky eater.
Okay. I'll admit, I'm definitely a picky eater, and I'm still not reformed. Okay, so let's review really quickly the senses that OTs use before we move on. Vestibular is one's body awareness as they move through space. So to remember that one, just imagine you have a tight vest on, and it's really impeding your movement. Vestibular. Proprioceptive. One's awareness of their body position. So that one's easy. Position and proprioceptive both start with the letter P. And finally, introception. That is one's awareness of their internal body sense and feelings. Intro means looking inward, and your feelings are inside of you. Okay. So I hope that you've got that. You might hear those words a few more times as we move on. For now, let's talk more about that gym that I mentioned at the beginning of the episode. You heard about crab soccer, but what else might an OT do in therapy?
So you did show me the gym that we were in, and yeah. I think somebody walking in would think like, oh, this is a playground, but I suspect that everything in there has a therapeutic value.
Yeah.
And so tell me, with these kids that have been exposed to drugs or who have a brain-based disability, and you told us about the senses, what do you do in the room or in a different setting to address those? What are some therapies that you might use?
Right. So the kids that might have difficulty like with balance or trunk or just getting their, it's called gravitational insecurity, getting their feet off the ground. Mm. We have swings back there that we put up, the different types of swings, and even a challenge of getting on a swing for some kids, especially if they can't control it, can be really yeah. intimidating. So I might put them on the swing. We might sing songs while they're on the swing, and I might even be able to get to start moving that swing a little bit. Or I might try to give them big vestibular input of, you know, spinning them or pushing them back and forth.
Speaking of big vestibular inputs, they have a zip line that leads right into a big ball pit. So when Chris asked if I wanted to try it out, of course I said yes. Of course, it's not all just fun and games.
Going in the ball pit, it, you know, seems like, well, what would you do with that? Well, the tactile experience of just being in that ball pit, and then for younger kids, it's almost like they feel like they're sinking down in it. Yeah, there's a little bit of trust issues, and playing, we might find things and have to feel for things. Sometimes just speech and language, just trying to develop that speech and language and supporting what the speech therapist might be working on, mm-hmm. asking for certain things while in the ball pit. We have a scooter board ramp back there. So we might be working on extension and developing just that body awareness of going down, moving through space and time to crash into a mat. Kids, they might be sensory seekers would be the other term. You know, a parent or a foster parent might see this kiddo crashing and banging into the couch, or they keep throwing themselves on the ground. Mm-hmm. What's that about? And that's that sense of proprioception that they're looking for. Like, it's increasing their awareness of where their body is in space and giving them some input. And so then we try to give them that input in a more appropriate way than throwing themselves on the ground, or, you know, if the parent's okay with them crashing into the couch, but giving them that specific time. It would be like a sensory diet. We're going to do this together. Like, what I did today was, we had some plastic eggs for Easter, and so we put some, I had the child I was working with who is on the autistic spectrum, he had to write some letters. We're working on his writing a little bit, because he doesn't have a good grasp, a functional grasp, really. It's a little delayed. And so he was copying some letters onto a piece of paper, and then we'd put them in the eggs. We were spelling out the word bunny, and then we would hide the eggs around, and he had to try to give clues as best he could without just pointing to where the eggs were or finding them to another person in the room, and he had to go find that person, go find the eggs. We're working on hot and cold. It sounds like, you know, some of the games that you would play when you were younger, similar things like that. Kids actually don't play as much as they used to, right? Climbing, being out in the park.
Or a lot more screen time.
More screen time, more two-dimensional versus three-dimensional. Problem solving. Problem solving is a great thing. You know, working as a group together, how can we build this together would be another thing.
And that's where you can kind of combine a physical therapy with social as well.
Yeah, we can do, so we'll do physical stuff, right? And I might be working with a physical therapist to do something. I might set up some type of activity, like an obstacle course, and maybe the PT might be working on trying to help develop this kid's ball skills, or, you know, activities that are trunk stability, things like that. And the speech therapist might be working on having this child initiate with another kid in the room. We all kind of work together and brainstorm, you know, what things do we want to work on. And so it depends on the session and the child, and it's very individualized.
So I hope that gives you a good sense so far of what an OT does and what kind of therapies they use for kids you may be working with or parenting. Now, I've got to say that this interview was fun, and not just because I got to zipline into a ball pit, although that was part of it. OT is a fascinating profession, and the sky is the limit for the kinds of creative and innovative therapies that they can use. You'll be hearing more about that in part two, by the way, so be sure to tune in. For now, I'll just finish by saying that I think that some of the best therapies are the ones that you don't even know that you're in. Visiting an OT is a really great opportunity for any kid. They get to learn life skills and have fun doing it, and I really don't see why fun and therapy need to always be separate anyways. Okay, so that's it. Our music is by Ira Wolf, and as always, if you want to get in touch with us, just send us an email at ccfwd@mso.umt.edu, or visit our website at www.health.umt.edu/ccfwd. Okay. So don't forget to tune in to our next episode, where we'll pick up right where we left off and talk about when an OT knows that a therapy is working and when they might need to take a step back and reevaluate. This has been part one of our interview with occupational therapist Chris Graydon on the Center for Children, Families, and Workforce Development podcast. I'm Zach Creamer. Thanks again to you, the listener, for tuning in. And be sure to take care of yourself. See you next time.